guy like me. I'm Phil Parn, and have a friend of mine. We don't live in the same town, and we don't hang out together, but we've known each other since we were 5 and 6 years old, and at our age, that is a long time. So I guess about 60 years. Burns Taylor, welcome to Blind Like Me, sir.
Thank you, Phil. Glad to be here.
I guess Burns and I started our tour of duty at the Texas School for the Blind in 1946 at the same time. You had a definite advantage on the rest of us, and tell us what that was.
Well, Phil, I lived at home, so I was what was...
A day student.
Somewhat infamously referred to as a day student.
A day student. which was great. You know, all your brothers and sisters were day students. So they went to school, but the rest of us were there 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And Burns, we'd be sitting on the curb out in front of Cottage K, and his car would roll up, and Burns would jump up, and his mom would say, "Hi, Burns." Burns would get in the car, and that would be the end of Burns till the next morning. Till the next morning, back to your normal, home life.
I didn't really realize, you know, what all of that, the implications of all of that, until much later when I hooked up with Bobby Doyle, and we began to, when we realized we were day students, that we had freedoms that other people didn't have. We abused them wantonly.
Well, I don't blame you. You should have abused them wantonly. But the thing I remember most about us as first and second graders, when Miss Biggs was our first grade teacher, the thing I remember most is lunch time. We'd go and eat our lunch in the dining room, and then after lunch, we would all sort of gather on the side of the cottage there where those troughs were that the rain came down. We would gather there, and we would all go back in the hedges, and we would form camps.
Yep.
Be Burns' camp or Bobby's camp or Phillip's camp or somebody, and usually there would be some sort of a war break out between this camp and the other camp. These wars didn't really amount to much, a lot of talking. Maybe a light pushing and shoving, but I noticed Bobby always had a camp, or he was Robert Doyle then.
That's right. And he had a story. They were like story camps, and we would we'd tell stories and trade information, and that's was the beginning of Bobby Doyle's life as an entertainer.
Yeah.
I must say he was one of the most, in Norman Mailer's terms, severely talented people I've ever known.
Well, we're going to do this, and then a little later in the future, if you'll send me some Bobby Doyle music, I'd like to do with you a show about Bobby and his talent, because I think you knew him about as well as anybody.
We grew up together pretty much. Rode to school together, got in trouble together, a whole lot of trouble together.
So, but you continued your close relationship as adults also, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We kind of drifted because Bobby went in the direction of a professional entertainer, and he moved away from Austin to Houston.
Sure.
That's where he hooked up with Kenny Rogers and made that connection that lasted for a lifetime.
And then to California, and then...
And then out to California, and then back. And
Came as close as anyone anyone could to being a major household name, being a major star. But anyway, we'll get into him later. Uh-huh. You, what happened to your eyes? Why are you... Why can't you see?
I was blinded in a gun shooting when I was 3 years old.
Obviously an accidental gun shooting.
Well, yes and no. I say that.
Well, I'm sorry. I hadn't heard this story.
Well, I didn't either until I was actually an adult. I never really got the full story. My brother picked up a rifle one day when I was 3 years old and shot me. And it was treated my mother, bless her heart, I guess in an attempt to keep the family together and make peace, because there was no, of course, professional counseling or anything available then in the 40s. We're talking 1944, World War II's going on.
Yeah.
And there was no really, you know, like we have today, all this family counseling and everybody's. But so she did her best to interpret what had happened and called it an accident. And then it was an accident. And then pretty soon it became your accident, meaning my accident, as if I caused the accident.
The accident was your fault.
I sort of bought into that, too. Crazy as a kid, it's the way you do. Until I got older, of course, and I said, well, it certainly wasn't my accident. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
But then, years later, when I was doing graduate work at the University of Southern California, doing autobiographical, you know, digging back through the past.
And yeah.
I spoke to my uncle, whose gun it was that my brother had used, and he said your brother knew how that gun worked. He had fired it before, had been out, you know, shooting at birds with it, so he knew how it worked. Of course, it always had been presented to me as if, well, he just carelessly picked up a gun, didn't know it was loaded, and pulled the trigger. Well, didn't quite happen that way. I think my brother really just didn't know what the consequences would be.
Yeah. How old was he when this happened? And we're back now. We just dropped out for just a minute. I'm getting a little ticking noise of some sort.
Okay, you're hearing that.
Maybe the FBI is tapping our phone.
No, it's the stupid satellite connection.
Is that what you're on, Vantage or something?
I'm on DSL, and I think it's the satellite connection that's making. That's going to be bad.
Maybe it'll be all right. I think I can filter it out mostly.
So,
we were talking about your brother, and how old was he when this happened? You were four.
I was three. I just had my third birthday about 10 days before,
uh-huh.
And he was a little over 11, about 11 and 4 years and 4 months.
Uh-huh.
And so,
well, we must think
was it quite an accident, more like maybe an experiment to see what would happen. The way kids do,
but he didn't realize. Surely he didn't realize that he was going to do irreparable damage to you. He was.
No, I don't think so.
I don't either.
I don't think it was. I think it was more like I said. Like, well, let's see what happens.
And
that's the way I describe it in the article that I'm going to have published, as if it were, well, let's just pretend the gun's not loaded. It's probably not loaded anyway, but we'll just see what happens when I pull the trigger. And there were some other kids there, so there was kind of a little bit of showing off in front of his cousins. And the situation was like one of those family things that involves everybody in the family had a piece of the guilt, and because my mother had gone off and left a house full of kids by themselves. My father was sleeping because he was working graveyard and was sleeping days. And so everybody had a piece of the guilt and regret for what happened. And so it took a long time for us to work through that, and we all suffered and
sure.
To one degree or another for what happened, and especially my brother and me. Our relationship was pretty much irreparably damaged.
Well, yeah. And your mother, your poor mother, who left.
Poor mother. Yeah.
Who left the children alone. Of course, this boy was 11, and it's, you know, leaving an 11-year-old alone is one thing, but you know, house full of.
There were several, you know, quite a few. There were at least two or three cousins and my sister and me and my brother, a bunch of kids. And she just ran to the grocery store. My dad was sleeping, so he felt like, oh, God, I should have, you know. And then my sister, she was seven.
Yeah.
And she told me years later that that my dad had always made her feel like she should have intervened or done something to be, you know, that thing. God, she was 7 years old. For
what could she have done?
Yeah. But she said she felt that from my dad, that he felt like she should have done something. But so it involved all of us. Or it was like
but
a shadow.
It happened, and it cannot be taken back. It cannot be reversed. It happened. You ended up a blind person.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're pretty much left to try to resolve the impact of that. And it's taken me a lifetime, pretty much.
One more question. Was it discussed on a daily basis at your house?
No.
Or was it simply swept under the rug and
not
talked about? It's something that happened?
Something happened. Let's forget it. It was an accident. Nobody responsible. It's like, boom. Okay.
The thing is, if that happened now, they would have taken you away from your parents.
Oh, Lord, there's no
The CPS would have been out there, and they would have taken you and put you in some foster home or done something with you to get you away from your...
Oh, yeah.
Which would have made, as far as I'm concerned, things a hell of a lot worse for you.
Victim of violent crime, you know. Stuff.
Oh, there would have been a big investigation.
Yeah.
It would have been on the news. You would have been taken. You would have been raised in foster homes.
Absolutely.
You would probably, the worst of things is you would have probably been a full-time student at that damn blind school. And how, it don't get no worse than that, kids.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, you got through it. You ended up at the school for the blind as young Burns Taylor, and you did not graduate there. You stayed a while, and then you ended up in public school, didn't you?
I transferred to McAllen Public School, high school in Austin, along with Bobby Doyle and Dolores Smith,
Suzanne Johnson,
and Lawrence Williams. Actually, we were the first blind students to enter the public school system.
Lawrence Williams, you and Bobby, and who else?
And Dolores Smith.
Dolores Smith.
And it was a real challenge because they really weren't ready for us. The teachers weren't trained. They didn't know. I'll never forget them asking, well, how do we test you? And I said, well, let's don't say we did.
Or do it orally.
Unfortunately, they found some lady in Austin that could braille the test for us, so that didn't last very long. But
now, this was what year was this that you made the switch?
1956.
So you had gone through about, I guess, about 9-10 grades of the blind school.
Mm-hmm. 10th grade. I finished 10th grade.
You finished 10th grade. So you just did the last year, junior and senior year.
11th and 12th grades
at
high school. And went on to UT Austin.
Yeah. It was, let's see, who else was in that class? Was Tommy Tolleson a part of your group?
Uh-huh.
And how about Marilyn,
Costa.
Marilyn Brandt?
Marilyn was behind or ahead.
Marilyn was a year behind or a year ahead.
Yeah.
I ask you about her because I've got her. She's married to a fellow named Roger Smith. We're going to interview them as soon as we get through with this Houston gathering that we're having. He's a snake handler. I talked to her the other day. She seems to be doing quite well, and I was thinking she was, Georgia Costa, Tommy Tolleson, I guess Pat.
Daniel Flores.
Pat Horton hadn't come then, had she? She was.
Who?
Pat Horton, Patricia Horton. She
Pat
was.
Pat Horton.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pat was there, but she wasn't in my class either. She was with Lloyd.
She was, and Lloyd, was Lloyd a year after us?
He was a year before.
You think a year before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, I was in your class, but I lost you. In the second grade, you folks moved on, and I stayed. Because Miss Haygood liked me better than, obviously, she did you all, so she kept me.
Held you back.
Held me back here because I couldn't read Braille, and I still can't. She was determined to correct that. She didn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started with you, but you were long. You got past me. A long way. So, McAllen High School in Austin, I guess that was different, but you were still going home at night. You were still, you know, you went to school every day.
No, it was totally different.
Yeah.
Standards, and like I said, they weren't ready for us, actually. Well, it was due to my mother's persistence. She was working for the administrative offices of the public schools, and she had written to California and all of these places to prove to the administrators in Austin that the blind were being mainstreamed in the public schools everywhere else or in a lot of other places. And they resisted, of course, because the school for the blind was right there in Austin. They said, what do you mean? We got a school right here. You know? But my mother fought the administration and drugged me kicking and screaming into the public schools. I didn't want to go either. I was institutionalized. I was very comfortable at the school for the blind. I made straight A's and didn't have to crack a book.
And it was right there,
and you
knew everybody.
Exactly.
So, you know, there you can almost say, what's the point?
Right. But my mom knew that somehow she was a very, very intelligent woman, even though she only finished the eighth grade. She knew I wasn't being challenged at the school for the blind, and that I needed to learn to be integrated into, you know, a broader society, and that there was big wide world out there that I wasn't being exposed to. So.
And in that context, she's right. She's absolutely correct.
Absolutely right. Ahead of her time.
There is a big wide world out there that you don't.
Of course, all the blind kids today are being mainstream. That's
oh yeah.
She was way ahead of her time, I tell you. But I don't know, and I don't know how she found all these people in California to say, "Yeah, we're mainstreaming the blind out here." And da da da.
But she got the other four students' parents to buy into it also, or the three.
Exactly. Yeah. So, she was quite a lady.
And so, away to public school you went, graduated from McAllen High, and did you do as well there academically as you did at the blind school?
No.
Really?
Absolutely not.
No,
I certainly didn't make straight A's.
Because you didn't have the books in Braille? You didn't?
No. And algebra, my mother had to read. My sister, my mother read me through high school and a big part of my college career as well. But there were no special, equipment or anything to help us with mathematics and all that stuff. It was a real chore. So, but I managed to get out of there with C's and B's and some A's. But it was tough.
Yeah, but it academically you didn't do as well at McAllen.
No.
All right, let's take a break and get you in college and what you decided you thought you could do with your life as a young 18, 19-year-old Burns Taylor. Our show is Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. Our guest is Burns Taylor from El Paso, Texas. Back in just a second. Hang on.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
Do you have some old records sitting around that you'd like to maybe restore and put on CD? Or some old tapes, whether they be cassette or reel-to-reel? Or even maybe some old wire recordings? And you don't want to take the trouble of trying to do it yourself, you don't have the software or whatever? Well, you should take a look at www.deepskyaudio.com. Deep Sky Audio is a company down in North Carolina that does audio restoration on old tapes and 78s and whatever. The thing I like about their site is it's very accessible, but the thing I like about the company, I haven't actually used them as a customer, but just looking at their site, the thing that I like is that a lot of these companies out there charge per hour in terms of the kind of noise reduction they do, whereas this company charges you one flat fee per tape or disc or whatever. They seem to do a very nice job. I listened to some of the samples on their site, and they were quite amazing. The website, again, is www.deepskyaudio.com. I'd give them an accessibility rating of a 9. This is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader-friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
I write a song that sings. sings your praise. I'm gonna lift my hands and say, thank you, love, for the joy you
All right, we are back with more of Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. Our guest is Barnes Taylor, who resides in El Paso, Texas. Went to school at the Texas School for the Blind through the 10th grade, transferred to McAllen High, did the last 2 years there in the in a public school, and succeeded, but not maybe not quite as well academically as he did at the School for the Blind. What did you think you could do to survive at age 18, 19 when you graduated McAllen?
I was originally enrolled at UT Austin in pre-law. I was going to be a lawyer. And, you know, in those days, Phil, the jobs that blind people could do were pretty much stereotyped.
Really?
You know, you're either a piano tuner or a broom mop salesman or a lawyer or
well, or
darkroom technician.
Cane chairs or made brooms.
Yeah.
Or and when we were kids, hustling on the street was perfectly normal for blind people.
Yeah.
Lots of them did it.
Yeah. So the job opportunities were pretty limited. And so I figured lawyer and got into that. And I don't know, after a couple of years, just figured, you know, there's sure a lot of hungry lawyers in the world. And I'm sure it's going to be a lot of reading and stuff. And maybe I ought to go a different direction.
All right.
And so I decided I'd be teacher. I liked several of my professors. I thought, well, that seems like a nice life. I could do that.
Uh-huh.
And so focused on that and got a degree and a BA degree in English, which is totally useless. It's like a degree in art history or something, you know. What are you going to do with
Garrison
a degree
Keeler,
in English?
Garrison Keeler says with a degree in English, you better learn how to say you want fries with that.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so I, at that point, actually, I went all the way through the university with the assistance from Texas Commission for the Blind.
Uh-huh.
But I very stubbornly refused to use a cane. I went all the way through university, and I've got, you know, scars on my shins that would scare people. I don't.
You walked all over the University of Texas campus without a cane.
Without a cane, yeah.
Because
Lloyd and I both did, and we followed the edge of the sidewalk and
you
ran
and,
into people. And
you and the rest of us, at the School for the Blind, we didn't use canes.
Uh-uh. So we weren't at that frame of mind, you know.
We
didn't have that mindset. So I never used a cane. Finally, the commission said, look, you want to go any further with us, especially if you're thinking about work, employment. You're going to have to go through Kerrville, which was then the rehab center before Chris Cole, which is now the
yes, I know.
Rehab center. So Kerrville. So I said, okay, the jig is up. And I went pretty much with the promise of employment and got hired shortly after finishing my...
Got hired by who?
By the Commission for the Blind.
Well, I didn't know that. So this is your second go-around with the Commission for the Blind.
Actually, yeah. If I had stayed, I'd have about 41 years.
And don't you wish you had? Don't
so they,
you wish?
They hired me and sent me out to El Paso in 65. I graduated 64, and then went through Kerrville in 65. They hired me. I came out here. I lasted for about 8 months and went on to another job. But
you only stayed 8 months?
Yeah. Yeah. Got offered a better job, more money.
Well, is the story of how you met your first wife off limits? I guess now that I brought it up, it isn't, is it?
No. My first wife was an employee of the Texas Commission for the Blind. She was a secretary in the Austin office. And so...
And you went in for assistance and ended up marrying the secretary. I love it. I think it's a great story.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have that
first
kind of...
took her away from her boss, I think.
Yeah. And ended up... You know, I didn't have that much nerve. That seemed like a nervy, gutsy sort of a Burns kind of thing to do when I first heard that story.
I had a lot of nerve in those days.
But you went out to the commission. You went out to El Paso as an employee of the commission for the blind. What did? Were you home teaching? What were you doing?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was a home teacher, which now they call rehab teacher.
And you didn't
teaching
like
the low ladies how to make moccasins and how to.
You didn't like it.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't like it. I kind of felt like a real employee.
Yeah.
The counselor was number one and king, and I was kind of second fiddle to the counselor. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of irked me. And then I was offered a job for quite a bit more money and a more challenging position. And just went for it.
Where was this?
It was with Goodwill Industries doing public relations work.
And this was in El Paso also?
Uh-huh.
And so you took that?
Yeah, I took that.
Well, no reason not to. It paid more.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. And, I mean, would you believe my salary at Texas Commission for the Blind 65 was $4,300 a year? A year?
No.
So I made about $50 a month more than the secretary. I thought, man.
Yeah.
For this, I got a degree. For this, I da-da-da-da. You know, so.
And the Goodwill offered you more money.
Yeah. It was about $1,000 a year more. Good $100 a month more income. So I jumped for it.
Yeah.
And I kind of did job jumping in the beginning. And I lasted only about 8 months there. Then I went into the poverty program and worked as an employment job developer with the poverty program back in the Great Society, the days of Johnson.
Yeah, days of Lyndon Johnson.
Working down in the real impacted ghetto areas here in El Paso, tenements. And that was exciting. That was very informative for me, working with people at that level. And learned a whole lot. And then decided to get back into graduate school at UTEP here and took a job as became the first blind instructor, English instructor, at UTEP, 1967.
Really? This was back in Austin?
No, this was in El Paso.
Okay.
UTEP, UT El Paso.
Okay.
In 1967, I started, I was called a graduate teaching assistant. So I had two classes.
Uh-huh.
Full charge teaching, you know, I did all the grading, did everything, and stayed with that job for about 3 years. And then the teaching assistantships were intended to be a temporary position, so they figured, well, you're going to be doing this while you're earning your master's degree, which I was working on a master's degree. But I kind of got burned out after 3 years and thought, you know, I did everything but the thesis here in El Paso. And I thought, you know, kind of tired of graduate school and kind of running out of my string here. And so I left there without really any direction, just sort of 1970 and early 70s were a real down, you know, probably a low, all-time low point in my life, I guess, my career. And wound up getting married again the second time. And 1971.
Yeah.
Went into the bar business. Oh, yeah, that was exciting. Got into the bar business here because I had a partner that we did a lot of drinking together, and we found this bar downtown that had been closed up for a couple of months because they were shut down for. Some people were smoking herb at the bar and closed them down.
Oh.
So my partner and I said, well, you know, if we can just get half our friends in here, we can cut down on our own drinking bill and maybe make a nickel or two. And so that's what we did.
Very poor thinking, but I would have bought into it had I been with you.
Absolutely. It makes total sense.
It does.
When you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, when you're drunk out of your mind for 3 days, it makes great sense. I've been there, son.
So we supported our habit and brought our friends in, and made a real go of it. I mean, starting from scratch, I can still hear that old compressor clicking away, and there's nobody there. Maybe one person would stray in, and my partner is saying, yeah, boy, I sure hope we can pay the rent this month. And we built it up to, well, I guess when I sold out to my partner in 73, we were up to about $200 a day, just beer and wine.
Yeah.
And he kept the bar for 20 years after I sold out to
Plus, you got to drink for half price.
Yeah.
Which was one of the major benefits.
Absolutely.
That I would have wanted. I would have. That would have been the thing for me. That would have lured me right in.
The big draw.
Getting to
25 cents a glass for draft beer, man. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can. I remember those great days. Quarter draft beer.
Yeah. Yeah. 60 cents for a little pitcher, 90 cents for the big pitcher. No, it's $1.25 for the big pitcher.
There is a picture somewhere Donald Patterson has of myself and Don Patterson, Charles Alexander, you remember him, maybe Charles Wiseman, and I can't remember, Danny Derringer or somebody. All five of us sitting at a table, and clearly there's a sign above this table that says, positively no one served under 21. And there we all are. There's a pitcher and glasses everywhere on the table. All of us, obviously not 21, sitting there lushing it up, you know.
Well, it was fun. I enjoyed serving beer. And you know, a funny story, when you're shooting draft beer, you tilt the glass so you don't have a big head.
Yeah, so you don't make a head, yeah.
Yeah, and so I would use my index finger. Of course, my hands are sparkling clean because you've got three sinks back there. You got your Clorox.
You're washing your hands all the time.
Your soapy side and all that. So I would use my little index finger, sneak it over the edge there, tell when I needed to straighten the glass up. And after I sold out to my partner, about a year later, I was in there one day talking to one of the customers, and he said, "You know, man," he said, and of course I thought I was being real sneaky, right? And
yeah.
He said, "You know, the beer just hadn't tasted as good since your finger left here."
you didn't think these guys were seeing you?
I didn't think anybody knew. I thought I was being real secretive about it.
You were actually behind the bar, and you'd walk down, some guy would say, "I need a slitch draft." Yes, you'd go fill it up and take it back to him.
Sure.
I could have done that. My hearing is long since, wouldn't allow me to do that now, but I could have when I was that age.
It was just a straight shoot, but, you know, back behind the bar.
You were early 30s?
Where all the canned beer was and everything, wine.
And so you put things in places like a blind person does, and then you remembered where the Schlitz were and where the Lone Star was and where the Pearl was and where what this and that. And
yes, sir.
So you could,
and we had two taps, actually. It was, I think Schlitz and Budweiser or something like that. So it wasn't real complicated.
The only problem I see with this plan is you say you're going to get all your friends in. Of course, your friends come in and they're before payday and they want a credit. They want credit or they want a drink for free. I'm your buddy. You're not going to charge me. Well, you know, that's the only problem I see. Other than that, sound like a good plan. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
You did.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I was in there for about a year and a half, and then my then second wife said, "You know, you're not home very much." I was spending way too much time at the bar, and my partner and I had developed a habit of locking up. At that time, we only had a 12 o'clock license. We'd lock up and just party on, you know. So
stay there till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
Go home, sleep till 2.
Mm-hmm.
Get up, take a shower, have a beer, and do it again.
And my kids are saying, "Mommy, who's that strange man I saw coming in last night?"
Yeah.
So.
Well, I've been there playing music where you do that. You come, let's go to Phil's house and smoke one and drink a little bit and talk about the night and play those guitars and learn a good new Eagles tune. And it'll be 5 o'clock in the morning. And you're, you know, I've been there when my second wife was getting up to go to work. She'd walk out in the playroom, and there we'd all be sitting, drinking. She's going off to the optical place to make a living, and here we are partying, you know, many times.
I know.
And then I wonder why she left.
Right. And you look up pretty soon, you look up, and she's gone.
And she isn't there anymore.
Hey, what happened?
But, you know, it couldn't be my fault, could it? Oh, God, no.
So So that marriage ended about the same way the first one did,
yep.
Going different directions. And then I, well, before that, after the bar business, a very interesting chapter of my life, I began teaching again at the El Paso Community College in 72. And along about 1974, they were going to change textbooks in the English department.
Yeah.
And at that, by that time, I had made a lot of, I'm a writer, of course, I have been all my life, and I had made a lot of contacts with fellow poets and writers in the area all over the Southwest. And I thought, hey, guys, you know what? How about if we adopt a textbook of contemporary Southwest literature, which I'm about to put together. So the textbook, I remember meeting with the textbook committee, and they said, well, that sounds a real interesting idea. Why don't you bring us a sample? So, man, and I'm telling you, Phil, this whole chapter, this was my first published article, actually. It was a story of how a blind man put together a publishing company.
Yeah.
This happened over a period of about 6 months. We began collecting manuscript. We contacted everybody we knew, said, look, give us your best as quick as you can. We need to submit it to textbook committee. We put all of the, got all this stuff, Xeroxed copies of everything, and put mm-hmm. them in some old, these old black, you know, notebook binders.
Mm-hmm.
Took them to the textbook committee. This was like in May. They looked it over and they said, hey, this looks real interesting. We need 2,000 copies by September.
Oh, 2,000 copies by September.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you do that?
So,
I mean, how, you know.
That began a thrill of a lifetime. That's over that summer of 74. Putting that thing together was just it was wonderful and it was terrible at the same time. And so, but we did it. We did it. We got the book out. And it was a mess. My partner and his wife, who are supposed to be proofreading, did a real lousy job of doing it. And the book was full of errors. And I was meeting friends and everybody. So, friends would come up to me in the bar and say,
yeah.
Hey, man, my name is Dobbs, not Dodds. You know, I said, sorry about that.
Man.
Hey, man, you left the last line of my poem. Oh, man, I'm so sorry. You know, like,
so they were supposed to be proofreading, and they weren't.
Yeah, they just did a lousy job.
And so you bought a Xerox machine, or what?
We had a printer, you know, we had a four-color cover and a illustrated, and it was a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book on the surface. It looked great. But inside, it had all these errors, typos.
And they paid you for this?
Huh?
They paid you?
Yeah, it was $5.95 a copy. They took the 2,000, and then we immediately went back into, okay, let's redo this with a different proofreader, and I paid a guy to redo it and came out with a much better edition that I ended up being very proud of. And they took a two-year adoption, so I ended up selling about 5,000 copies of the book, and I still have a box of them. And kind of laughingly refer to that quote by Thoreau saying, well, I have a library of, 400 books, over 200 of which I've published myself. That was Thoreau's line. I love it. That was a wonderful and exciting chapter. And then I went to L.A. and got into a master's of fine arts program in professional writing and actually wrote an article, a story about that whole adventure of putting that book together. And got it published in a national magazine, Publishers Weekly, which was my first publication. I actually got paid for that one. Real nice.
Really?
New York Magazine. It's kind of the organ of the publishing industry, and they have the definitive bestseller list and all that stuff.
Really?
And they published my article, Shoestring Publisher. What can you expect from a blind proofreader? That was my...
I like it. I like it.
It was a funny article.
All right, what did you do in the 80s and 90s? What did you...
Well, the 80s... actually, that's when I moved to L.A. in 78.
Yeah.
and got into a Master of Fine Arts program at the University of Southern California, which was my most exciting schooling ever. It was a wonderful school, taught by people who were publishing at the time. I actually took a class with an author who at the time had a book on the bestseller list, the name of Tommy Thompson. He wrote a book called Blood and Money, which was his big seller, about this doctor in Houston that had murdered his wife slowly over a period of time.
I've read it. It's a great book.
I actually studied with that man. Can you believe?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, really.
It was thrilling. It was a thrilling adventure.
But you're still going to school. You weren't teaching. You're still...
I was just going to school, and I got my master's, MFA, Master of Fine Arts, and began teaching at Los Angeles City College in 1984. Taught there for... Oh, and that was... The L.A. adventure is... all of this, is, of course, is I'm working on as my work in progress in my autobiography, but
yeah.
That period was exciting. I was teaching at the college, and actually before I started teaching, I guess it was about 1981, I was based at the Braille Institute in Los Angeles, which is a fantastic...
Karen Applegren.
Yeah.
Works
Carmen.
There. Carmen Applegren.
Yeah, you know Carmen?
Yeah, no, I've interviewed her. It's a wonderful lady. Very bright. Was an actress at one time and faked it.
Very
they
good
said she was. They didn't give her the part because they thought she was on drugs because her eyes were open so far. She was trying to see what the hell was going on. They didn't give her the...
She's a wonderful lady.
She's a beautiful lady.
I love her. Carmen Applegren.
I love her to death.
Anyway, 1981,
yeah.
I connected with this guy who was making a movie, a documentary called, ended up being called Beyond Blindness. His focus was to present all aspects, all different levels of blindness, from people who had been newly blinded to people who had been blind for a long time, and just to present their lifestyles, how they lived, how they coped daily with the disability. Mm-hmm. And I connected with him and showed him a manuscript that I had written quite a while before with a friend of mine about the whole experience of being disabled. And he said, well, you know, how about helping me put this script together? And so I said, well, sure, I'd be glad to do that. So I did, and then I became one of the featured performers in the movie, and I got screen credits as a contributing writer. It was a one-hour documentary. It was narrated by none other than Patty Duke.
Really?
Played Helen Keller.
Yeah.
Did she play Helen Keller, or did she play the other one?
I know who Patty Duke is, but...
Yeah,
so she narrated
the film, which I still have a copy. It was an excellent, excellent film. And I was one of four people to be featured off and on throughout the movie. He would cut away and go somewhere else, and then come back to us doing whatever we were doing.
What was the purpose of this film? Where was it going to show it on? Public TV?
It came out. Yeah, it was on PBS television all over the country. People call me and say, hey, man, I saw you in a movie. And I said, okay.
But this was early 80s.
It was on PBS television, yeah. And I was very proud of my work on that, everything, and got the screen credits, which really thrilled me. And then I began teaching at Los Angeles City College. And in 1987... another big period of excitement. I just for being at the Braille Institute, I guess, they came there from a show. There was a TV game show called The $25,000 Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
Dick Clark, our old friend Dick Clark.
Everybody knows Dick Clark.
They came there. They specifically wanted some blind contestants for the show. And so I went up there, auditioned, got picked. This was 87. Got on the show and spent a whole day at the studio,
mm-hmm.
Doing filming and doing the show. Ended up winning almost $12,000 and a trip to Puerto Vallarta for 6 days.
Now, this was a show like Jeopardy? I mean, what did they ask questions?
No, it wasn't questions. You worked with a celebrity.
Okay.
And they gave you clues, and you were supposed to... Like, for example, they give you examples of something, and you're supposed to name the category.
Okay.
You know, like they would say, the silverware, the microwave, the dishwasher.
Category B.
Oh, things in the kitchen.
Things in the kitchen.
Yeah, right. Things in the kitchen. Okay. And you're supposed to give the big category that included all the examples.
Okay. Gave.
And you'd have, it was all timed, of course. You had so many seconds to.
$12,000 and a nice trip to Puerto Vallarta.
Puerto Vallarta, yeah.
Well, what a deal.
Yeah, and a brand new stereo system, full stereo. I won everything on the show, and the poor girl that was my competitor, she didn't win a thing.
Oh, well.
Not a thing, and I felt bad for about 10 seconds.
Oh, not very long. Oh, well. You know. We do what we can. We do what we have to. All right. 90s, what did you do all during the 90s? You were in California.
Well, 90s, no. Things kind of turned sour in L.A. in the 90s. Property values went through the floor, and the economy just kind of went in the toilet. And they cut back on the community college teaching level out there. I was teaching two classes and drawing Social Security, and they all of a sudden said, okay, none of the part-time people can have more than one class. I said, no, man, I can't live on that. So I picked up the phone one day and called El Paso, where I taught before, and said, hey, John, what's going on over there? Well, he said, I can give you two classes in the fall and three in the spring. I said, I'm packing.
I'm on the way, yeah.
I started packing. So my wife, we're going to El Paso, right?
Yeah.
And so that was 91. I returned to El Paso. El Paso, I call it El Paso Take Two. And it is. It's been a totally different take.
And you stayed there until the commission offered you what you are doing now, right?
I was teaching part-time at the community college, and by 97, I just was pretty burnt out on teaching. This was like 19 years of teaching college English, composition, literature. And so got a chance to take a job with the commission as an employment assistant specialist, and have been there for, it'll be 10 years next year.
And you're still there, 10 years
and
next year. And I think
I have been doing freelance writing the whole time. I've been back here. And have done a lot more publishing, and got some stuff coming up on the horizon. So,
okay, that's where we are now. So you're now still an employee of the Commission for the Blind, and let's get current at 2006. Something you have written is about to be published. So just give us the synopsis of that.
A year ago, I received a. Email from a friend of mine in California, actually, regarding a competition for a proposed Helen Keller anthology of essays by persons with different disabilities who have successfully coped with a handicap or disability. And so I said, oh, what the heck? So I decided I'd enter it, send in a piece, really kind of a synopsis of my childhood, of the accident we talked about earlier, the shooting, and going up through about high school or something like that. And sent it off and got a letter back in a couple of months saying, you're a finalist. And and that was, after that, I didn't hear anything. A year later, just about 2 weeks ago, I'm sitting in my office, I get an email saying, okay, we found a publisher, we're publishing the book, I need your manuscript right away. Oh, man, I got 5 days to put this together.
They already had your manuscript.
Well, but they wanted it, and the publisher wanted it in text format. See, what I sent in was a hard copy.
Okay.
So they would have had to scan and da 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 da.
So they wanted it on the computer.
Yeah, they wanted the computer, and they wanted it in a text format. In an email, not an attachment.
I got you.
All these. So I said, okay, here it goes. I sent it off, and this anthology is now, I've spoken to the publisher who is located in Maryland at the Loyola College in Maryland.
Uh-huh.
And they're saying, well, it's going to be published just as soon as we can get all the manuscript in. Anybody who's interested can check at a website. It's www.com. Apprentice House, APPRENTICE House, HOUSE.com for details on when the book went up. But as I understand it, it's going to be translated into several languages, and they're going to circulate it worldwide in an attempt to use it as a means of raising money for the Helen Keller Foundation, which I approve of.
Now, this is there are many stories of blind people dealing with blindness, and that's what this book is about.
Yeah, that's what. Well, the anthology actually is going to be a collection of these essays, which were submitted by people with different disabilities, not just blindness. I guess deafness, blind deaf. I really don't know what the panorama of essays will look like, but apparently they solicited from all over the world for this competition, and so I'm sure there'll be essays from crippled, deaf, blind, every disability you think of.
Yeah. Now this has nothing to do with this book. There's a guy that I think his name is maybe Mark Maurer that was. Editor of Ziegler magazine, has written also a book about Helen Keller. These are two separate. This is not what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, no, this is not about Helen Keller. It's an anthology, Bill, which is a collection.
I understand.
Of essays, and it's going to be used to promote the Helen Keller Foundation and as a fundraiser, as a way of bringing in funds to the foundation. So they will sell the book.
Sure.
And bring in funds to the Helen Keller Foundation. So
yeah,
and I'm guessing, hoping it'll be out by the end of the year, the first of next year, probably.
And they'll sell 1,000 copies to corporate sponsors and things of that nature.
Yeah, and I guess be circulated around. They said around the world and translated in different languages. And I don't know how they intend to distribute the book. But I'm excited. It's taken my exposure to a whole different level.
Sure.
I have written for a national magazine, but this is going to be beyond that.
Yeah, but so, that was a good while ago. You needed a little career boost or whatever.
Exactly.
Would call it. I think it's neat that they got a lot of submissions and you were chosen.
Yeah. So it's an honor, and it's something I'm proud to be associated with.
We should be. And I see, I read, I think, a little piece or a poem that you had done in the Braille...
Braille Forum?
Yeah, the Braille Forum. Is that ACB or NFB? That's ACB. Right?
ACB.
Yeah, ACB's magazine a couple of years ago.
Exactly. I have a little short piece here I could read.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes, 3-4 minutes.
Okay.
All right, we're ready.
The name of my piece is going to be in the book. It's called The First Star I See. And this is about my sister and I growing up. At times I was stricken by spells of profound loneliness and isolation. They came over me unexpectedly like a trance, cutting me off from the rest of the world. Sometimes, even in the midst of boisterous play with other children, their voices would fade away and become muffled. And I imagined myself standing marooned on the edge of a huge lake. All I could hear was wind in the trees, water lapping against the shore, and far, far away, the buzz of talking and muted laughter, but not for me. I felt stranded and alien and alone in an alien place, lost and blind, with nothing but the sound of my own words to comfort me. I was afraid to take a step for fear of falling over a rock and into the water. And just then, at the very peak of my desperation, I'd hear a long, loud, reassuring yell from the other side of the lake. It would always be my sister's voice saying, "Hey, you, better get your butt back over here. It's your turn now. Come on, I'll show you how." Gwen was the one who told me about sunsets and rainbows. She'd raise my hand and pointing at the evening sky, we would chant in unison, "Starlight, star bright, the first star I see tonight." She mystified me with her vivid descriptions of colors and the other miracles of sight. She was my eyes, my vision, my teacher. That was tribute to my sis.
That is very nice. I'm looking forward to this, and you say it'll be out sometime before the end of the year?
Well, I have no idea. The guy publisher just said, you know, check that website that I gave it.
Well, we're out of time completely. You will let me know when it is published and when it is available so that I can announce that here on Blind Like Me.
Indeed.
Our guest has been Burns Taylor. Burns, thank you a lot, sir. It's been very interesting, and I'll look forward to visiting with you.
Been a pleasure, Phil. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. By the time this little show runs, we'll be in Houston, Texas, enjoying ourselves. This will be run on Saturday, I suppose, the third night of the third, and then the fourth on ACB Radio, and I don't know when else on radio reading services and things, but we'll be in Houston. The shows we record in Houston are at least the Blind Like Me and Blind Handyman. Those shows will be aired next week on here on ACB Radio and on wherever you happen to listen, radio reading service in Dallas or Chicago or wherever you happen to listen. Those shows will be produced this week, put together this week, and aired, unless anything, something bends or breaks, on the 10th, the night of the 10th, and then all day on the 11th. So if you didn't make the Houston gathering, you'll be able to hear us making fools of ourselves and having a big time. We'll probably do this again in a year or two, and so start saving your nickels and dimes. If you didn't make this one, maybe you can come to the next one. Thanks for listening. If you know somebody that would like to be a guest, or if you would like to volunteer as a guest, we always need guests, and the purpose of the show is to show, to demonstrate to folks that have lost their eyesight that while it is an inconvenience, it certainly can be done. One can have a fulfilling, good life as a blind person. I certainly have, and most of you have also. So come and join us on Blind Like Me. My phone number is 936-634-9500. You can call, set up an appointment, or to do a show with us, or email me, phil@philpar.net. PHIL@PHILPARR.net. Come and see us, and thanks for listening to Blind Like Me, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.